Good morning. Today's daf in Yevamos Pei Dalad. The objective today is to finish up the 8th parak of the Masech to begin the 9th parak. Let's get underway. In the 8th parak, the last of the 8th parak, 8th parak is a long parak. Goes all the way back to daf Ayin. We've been in this 8th parak now for nearly 2 weeks in daf Yomi terminology. That's a long time. And the 8th parak deals with Arelus. And not just an Arel, but a number of complications that takes place in terms of a man in his private area. We've been talking about androgynous. We've been talking about tumtum. Androgynous categorizes as what? Anatomically, it's a man and a woman. So mutation has caused the person to exhibit both primary sexual characteristics. And so what halakhically is he? So that is a complex discussion. It's a machlokas. Machlokas amongst the Tanaim, machlokas amongst the Amoraim. Exactly where to put him categorically. Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan have been debating this point all the way since Pei Aleph. So this has been an extensive discussion within the Gemara. So that is Pei Aleph, Pei Beis, Pei Gimel. Three Dapim here in Yevamos discussing what exactly is going to be his halachic status. So his anatomical status is clear, but his halachic status is unclear. Rav Yochanan's of the position that he's a Zachar Ma'aliyah, he's a bona fide Zachar. And it seems to be that Rav Yossi's of that position as well. But as we learned in yesterday's stuff, that's confusing. We really don't know what Rav Yossi is of the position because we have Rav Yossi of the Mishnah and we have Rav Yossi of the Braisa. Rav Yossi of the Mishnah seems to clearly be of the position that it's a Zachar Ma'aliyah. That's for sure a male. Rav Yossi of the Braisa says, no, not necessarily. Suffolk or Beri Bifnei Atzma. Either we don't know which box to check. It could be male or female. And Suffolk or the alternative way to say the Rav Yossi of the Braisa is that it's a Beri Bifnei Atzmo, it's its own separate category. Regardless, so we've been discussing androgynous now for some time. And then yesterday we moved the discussion to Tumtum. So Tumtum is the other questionable person in terms of gender, where we're uncertain with the gender. Here the uncertainty is predicated on a very simple fact that the primary sexual characteristic is being covered. So there's a membrane covering the area. So basic functioning in terms of urination, I don't know. I don't know how it works, but I imagine that, look, they knew what they were looking at, and they certainly had empirical evidence that there's such a thing existed. And then it's just a question of now, how would halacha view such an individual? So with the tumtum, it's just a simple question of being a suffix. We don't know. But then, as far as yibum is concerned, there's another complication as well. Because let's say the membrane does tear open. Either it tears open or a surgery was performed. Yesterday we saw that they had some sort of basic surgery where they tore open the membrane. Okay, so our tumtum. So even if it's discovered to be the tumtum was a male, so is he able to progenate? Is he potent? So as we learned yesterday, Rabbi Yehuda says no. In other words, we assume impotence when it comes to the tumtum. Okay, again, it probably was an empirical fact that existed back in the day. That if in fact there was a tumtum, and if in fact tumtum turned out to be male, so he was impotent. So as far as yibum is concerned, so there's no mitzvah of yibum because again, by yibum the whole purpose of the mitzvah of yibum lahakim shem achiv. Good. So that is the tumtum. On that, we noted that even though Rav Yehuda says that he's impotent, Rav Yosef Rav Yehuda said, "No, we don't know for sure that he's impotent. It's just that." We strongly suspect that he's impotent. What's the difference between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi halachically? What's the nafkamina between the two? That's where we ended off yesterday. We said over the two nafkaminas. We're going to pick it up right where we left off yesterday. We're on Pei Gimel Amud Beis. So again, we have this chus of finishing up the eighth parak of the Masechta. Let's begin. Amar Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Amar Rabbi Abba, Achua de Rabbi Yehuda Bar Zavdi, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rava, and Drogonis Chayin Alav Skila, Mishtei Mekama. So here the Gemara has an indelicate discussion regarding the androgynous in terms of him being involved in an act of Mishkav Zachor, homosexuality. So it's a capital crime, and so if we establish that he's a male, again, with what degree of certainty is open for discussion, which we already went over in the intro, but nevertheless, if he's involved in a homosexual activity, so it's Mishkav Zachor, qualifies as Mishkav Zachor, all the way to the point in which he's going to be Chayev Misa, meaning if there are witnesses and there's a warning, and you go through the entire due process, so he's subject to Misa. But the Chiddush over here is as follows. Now, we heard this yesterday, meaning this is the second time that we're reviewing this point, and now we're just going to delve a little bit deeper into this point, and that's the following. So he has two orifices in which could be penetrated, meaning he has the regular orifice. When I say regular, I mean in terms of Mishkav Zachar's concern. So that is Biashloka Darko. But he also has a female orifice as well. He's an androgynous. So if he's involved in Bia in his female orifice, is that going to be considered an act of Mishkav Zachar? So according to Rav Yehuda Merav, yes. Meaning, so both of those orifices are going to be recognized as acts of Bia. He is a man, so therefore, either way, he's going to be considered an act of Mishkav Zachar. Meisvei, the Gemara challenges Rebbe Lazar, Omer, androgynous, chayim, alav, skiel, kibbe Zachar. Ba'medvar, mamorim, bezachar, shalom, avam, nachvish, shalom, potter. So here the Gemara quotes the Brisa. And the Brisa says, B'shem Rebbe Eliezer, that he is a man, and if he's involved in Mishkav Zachar, it is an act of Mishkav Zachar, but only be a shalom, kedarka. That's only with his male orifice, not the female orifice. So who damer ki aitana? So the Gemara says, okay, I hear you. So Rabbi Eliezer certainly does not agree that there are two acts of Bia with this androgynous. But the Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, quoting, it goes all the way back to, Rav. Rav was following a different braisa. So who damer ki aitana? Did Tanya, Rabbi Simai, Omer androgynous, chayav nalav skila? Okay, so Rav Simai is of the position of Shtei Mekamos. So, an indelicate discussion in the Gemara regarding the androgynous, regarding what happens if it's involved in a homosexual act, but the orifice is being penetrated is not to be a shloka darka, but rather his female orifice. So is that considered an act of Mishkav Zachor? And it's a machlokis amongst the Tanayim. And so here the Gemara goes over the back and forth in terms of what is behind this machlokis, my time with the Rabbi Simai. Amar Rav Bar Hamduri, Asberli. So the Gemara gives the following explanation based on the Psukim in Parshas Achrimos. Achrimos, of course, is where you're going to find the Arayos, and of course is where you're going to find the Isser of Mishkav Zachor. And the Pasuk reads, Ve Zachar lo tishkav Mishkave Isha. So a Zachar may not have relations Mishkave Isha like a woman would have, meaning a homosexual act. So Ezu Zachar Shesh Bo Shnei Mishkavos. Now, over here, had we not had the Gemara, had you just had the Pasuk in Chumash, so, of course, the Pasuk would just simply mean that you can't be involved in homosexual activity. Okay, it's really that simple. But the Gemara now is going one layer deeper, meaning in the Pasuk it says, Mishkavei Isha. Mishkavei, of course, is Lashon Rabim. So what kind of person can possibly have two different ways of having Mishkav? So Aviyam is androgynous, so that's the androgynous. And what the Torah is telling us is that the Pasuk over here is a reference to androgynous, meaning it's unbelievable. The Pasuk, the Gemara is leaving the Pasuk Pshad, the Pasuk, and telling us that the Pasuk is referring to androgynous, meaning that the Torah is recognizing that there is such an entity of an androgynous, and the Torah is telling us that for him, having relations with another man would qualify as Mishkav Zachar, both on the Bia Shalok Kedarka and even on the Bia Kedarka. I'm saying Bia Kedarka over here contextually. Obviously, this is not normal, but in other words, but because he has a nakvus, so therefore, I'm just calling it Biakadarka. So the Avirabanan, now the Chachamim who disagree, Afagav Dias Beish Ne Mishkavos Es Zachar Ksiv. So what the Chachamim will tell you is that no. The Torah says Et Zachar, meaning that even though, you're right, it is talking about androgynous, but Et Zachar. But the only way that it will qualify as a capital crime, subject to the death penalty, is only when the penetration is going from the Bia Shalom Kedarka, meaning the way that homosexual activity normally is performed. V'rabanan, Zachar Greta Menalahu. So now the following question. Once the Torah is talking about androgynous, so where in the Pasuk do I see just the simple act of Mishkav Zachor? Meaning, we are now saying that the Mishkav Eisha is a reference to the androgynous. So where in the Pasuk do we have Mishkav Zachor? So, Es Isha. So we learn, right, in our Gemara we have the words Meisha, Beisha. Okay, the Gemara needs to be edited a little bit over here. The Bach edits the Gemara. So it comes from the word Es. Es Isha. Es Isha is there to tell me that the Es is referring to the regular act of Mishkav Zachor. Shalok Kedarka Menalahu. How do I know that it's Shalok Kedarka? Me Veisha. So it comes from the It comes from the extra word v'isha, which is a superfluous word, and so therefore that's how we know that it is an act of it's b'ish lo kedarka. Okay, so where are we right now? We just did a little bit of darshaning on the psukim regarding the androgynous machlokes taraim. When penetrated, when having an act of relations with another man and being penetrated by another man, so when does it qualify as a capital crime? So certainly when it comes to Bishlo Kedarka, unequivocally that is a capital crime. But what if the penetration is coming from the front side, from his nakvus? Machlokes tanaim, whether it's a capital crime. And then just a back and forth in the Gemara regarding how to darshan the psukim. Amar of Shizbi, Amar of Chisa, Lola Kol, Amar of Abelazar, and Jokshan of Zachar Malyahu. We have now been going over the position, Rabbi Elazar, that Androshan is Zachar Ma'aliyah. Now, Rabbi Elazar back in the Mishnah says that if he's involved in an act of homosexuality, so it is a capital crime, meaning, obviously, he's a man, right? If we didn't know if he was a man or a woman, so certainly he wouldn't be put to death. It wouldn't be a capital crime. It would certainly be Aser. That's unquestionable, meaning there's a good chance he's a man. It would absolutely be Aser, but it wouldn't be a capital crime. So by Rebbe Lazar issuing an execution, capital crime, so therefore he clearly is viewing this androgynous as a male. That part is clear. However, what the Gemara now is going to do is at least limit a little bit the sheet to Rebbe Lazar. Okay, so let's start that again. Amar Shizbi, Amar of Chisalo, Lukol Amar Rebbe Lazar, Androgynous Zachar Ma'aliyahu, Shimata Omer Kain, Bimukdashim Yikdash. The androgynous is not an absolute male in every respect, in every halachic avenue. How do I know that? Because if we were talking about mukdashin, so then it should be eligible to be offered as a carbon. Meaning if we had an androgynous animal, so then you should be able to offer it as a carbon. And meanwhile, it's not offered as a carbon. In fact, you can't be makdish it as a carbon. Now, how do I know I can't be makdish as a carbon? Tan rabbanan. So here we have the following brisa. Hanir vavam muksavah nevad. So here we are going over a series of animals that are disqualified. So nirva, an animal that was involved in an act of bestiality. So it was penetrated by a man. And as Rashi points out over here, we're talking about birds. In other words, carbon birds. So hanirva. Which, by the way, it will become clear that we're talking about birds over here because we're going to be talking about Malika. But also another hint, another clue that we're talking about birds is because normally it says harovea vehnirva, right? Rovea is where the animal itself penetrates a man or a woman, and nirva is where it's being penetrated by virtue of the fact that we're talking about a bird. So there's only nirva, there's not rovea, because the genitalia of a bird is not exterior, it's interior. And so, therefore, there's not going to be rovea. Okay, anyway, a subtlety, if you will. So, hanirva v'hamuksa v'hanevad v'ha'estan u'michir. So, these are all various disqualifications when it comes to a carbon. Nirva, as we just went over, is where it was involved in bestiality. Muksa was set aside for avodah zara. Nevad, it was actually worshipped as avodah zara. Estan, it was exchanged for prostitution. Michir, it was exchanged for a dog. Okay, if this is the first time you're hearing this, I know all this sounds a little bit strange, but these are classic disqualifications of the carbon. V'tumtum v'androgynous, same thing with tumtum, same thing with androgynous, metamim begadim abeis ablia. So what happens if you go ahead and this animal was mukdash, and now what do you do with a carbon bird? So we all know you do malika. So you take your fingernail, the kohen takes his fingernail, inserts it into the back of the neck of the bird, and that's the shechit of a bird. Okay, now, under normal circumstances, what's malika? It would render a bird under any other circumstance as an avela. Why? Because you didn't shech the bird. Normal shechita requires a back and forth motion with a knife from the front of the neck. And over here, the thumb is pressed into the back of the neck. And it's just it's an oddity in halacha, but it's just the reality of halacha that when it comes to a karban, that is a proper procedure of shechita. Meaning the bird now is perfectly acceptable. Now, as far as birds and carbonates are concerned, as we've gone over numerous times, the bird can only be offered as a chatas or nola. So as far as an nola is concerned, no one's eating it. But as far as the chatas are concerned, the kohanim are eating it. The kohanim are eating nevela, right? Of course not. The kohanim are not eating nevela. What the kohanim are eating is a kasher carbon, where the way that it is shechted, we'll put that in quotes, is by going to the back of the neck. So over here, an assortment of disqualified birds, where Malika was done, and now, is it acceptable? No. Now, once we say that it's not acceptable, so now let's call it a better name. If it's not acceptable, what is it? It's an avela, meaning it's not a carbon, it's not an acceptable way to kill it, to shecht it, so to say. And so therefore, it is a nevela. And now, what do we know regarding the nevela of a bird? So there's a special kind of tumma by the nevela of a bird. And that is that if you ingest a kazais of that bird, so then you're going to become tummy. This is what's called tumas beis habalia. By eating, by consuming this bird, you're going to become tummy. Aside from the fact that you violated the prohibition of eating nevela, that goes without saying. But in addition to that, you're also going to become tamei as well. So in all these circumstances, because the bird is disqualified as a carbon, so therefore it does not have kedushas carbon, and therefore if malika is done, it, you've rendered the bird nevela, and therefore if you've eaten it, you are tamei begadam abeis ablia. Okay, that, and I say this with pun intended, that's a mouthful. That right? That's a lot of information. So Rebbe Lazar, Omer, tum tum van jogan, say matamei begadam abeis ablia. Ah. So Rebbe Lazar says that when it comes to tumtum and androgynous, so ematam begadim abeis ablia, meaning that it's not going to become a nevela. Shaya Rebbe Lazar Omer komakum shenem rezachar nekeva atam motzi tumtum va'androgynous mi b'neim v'ol v'olo nem rebo zachar nekeva I atam motzi tumtum va'androgynous mi b'neim. So when it comes to birds, so gender is non-specific, meaning that the Torah never is interested in us figuring out what gender the bird is, right? You'll know that when it comes to carbonus of an animal, so most of the time, the Torah is specific. You need, for this, you need a male. For this, you need a female. Sometimes it's the Torah does not discriminate which gender we need, but most of the time by a carbon of an animal, so there is a discrimination. You have to know whether it's a male or a female. Carbon Pesach, male. Carbon Ola, male. Carbon Chatos, female. And it's Asha, male. Etc., etc. So the shlamim can go either way. But when it comes to a bird, even an ola bird, we don't have to distinguish whether it's male or female. Okay? And so what Rabbi Elazar is just simply pointing out is that even if I had a tumtum, an androgynous bird, so the because the Torah is not particular about us establishing whether it's male or female, so even in the case of tumtum and androgynous, where tumtum we don't know, androgynous we also don't know, but because exhibits both genitalia, so therefore the Torah is not, the Torah does not care whether or not it is male or female, and if it's an androgynous also, we don't care. What did we just learn together? What we just learned together, that even though Rebbe Elazar by a human qualifies the androgynous as being a male, a definitive male, but when it comes to the bird of a carbon, Rebbe Elazar is not qualifying it as an absolute male. Okay, so there is even a limit to the sheet of Rebbe Elazar. It is a limited limitation, significantly limited. We're only talking about birds as it relates to carbonus, and it's nafka mina regarding tumas abeis ablia, but there's a small limit of Rebbe Eliezer. And now we get to conclude. Amrav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Af Anan Namitanina Rebbe Elazar Omer. Hakalayim v'treifa v'yotzi delfin tumtum v'adjoganus lo kedoshim v'lo makdishim. So when it comes to kalayim treifa, kalayim where you cross the animals, treifa where the animal has some sort of internal wound and it's going to die, yotzi delfin it came out cesarean, another disqualification for a carbon, tumtum and adjoganus lo kedoshim v'lo makdishim, you can't be makdishit, v'amashmu lo kedoshim b'tmura v'lo makdishim b'osa tmura. So what does it mean kedoshim? Kedosha means that I can't exchange it with another carbon, meaning this week's parsha. Okay, that's exciting. I didn't mean this week's parsha. I take it back. Last week's parsha. Okay, I was close. Anyway, so the issue of Tamura of going ahead and exchanging Kedusha, so lo Kedoshim b'Tamura v'lo Magdishin b'Oset Tamura. Okay, on either direction of being either part of the exchange, so it's not going to be it's not going to be invested with Kedusha. Okay. Again, another Bryce is just simply pointing out that according to Rabbi Eliezer, the androgynous bird is not, or the androgynous carbon, I should say better, is not a zachar ma'alya. In other words, the Torah does not render it as an absolute male. Okay, good. And one last point, Rabbi Lazar Omer, Chayev Nalav Beskila Kezacher, Tanya Amar Rebbe, Keshalachti Lomo Torah, Eitzel Rabbi Lazar Ben Shamoah. So Rebbe records that when he went to go learn Torah by Rabbi Lazar Ben Shamoah, so Chavra Alai Tamidav, Ketana Golem Shal Beis Bukya. So what happened was is that I got roughed up a little bit, not physically, but in other words, but they were around me like chickens pecking. And they didn't let me learn only one thing. Okay, I'd love to hear the backstory over here, meaning a little more context. Why is it that they were a little bit antagonistic to him? I'm being nice, a little bit antagonistic. They would only let him learn one thing. So unclear exactly what happened over here. What are the circumstances that led to his treatment? I don't know. And usually the Gemara would comment in terms of why he received such treatment, normally when going to a new yeshiva. So especially now. So most of the time you're welcome with open arms. Okay, this is not exactly a hero's welcome. Anyway, there's a story behind the story. I just don't know it. So Ella Davar Acha b'Mishnasen Rabbi Lazar Amar Judgin is Chayev and Alav Skila Kezacher. And so the only thing they allow me to learn is this one halacha tucked away here in the eighth parak of Yevamos, that an androgynous is viewed as a zachar vaday. Okay. I wish I could share more regarding the story, but hajal lachaaro, that is the end of the parak aro. And here we are about to begin the ninth parak of the Masechta. Again, I've made this comment already a couple of times. Remarkably, we are done with the Masechta halfway in terms of parakim. Meaning this is a 122 blot Masechta, and we're on 84. We're most of the way done. We're more than two-thirds done through the Masechta, and yet in terms of parakim, we're halfway done. Meaning we have another eight more parakim to go. We finish eight, and we got eight to go. Okay, so that's eight parakim in 40 days. Okay. Which, obviously, the law of averages will tell you that these are really short parakim. Right? The first half of the Masechta in terms of parakim occupy two-thirds of the Masechta in terms of Dapim. Okay, those are your stats of the day. Okay, we go back, we start with this Mishnah. Okay, here, in the opening Mishnah here of the ninth parak of the Masechta, so we get to review. Okay, it's really good. Meaning that at this point in time, we have amassed a lot of information regarding the mitzvah of Yibum. Yibum is by far and away one of the most complicated mitzvahs and halachas in the Torah. There is drama, and there's a lot of intricacies regarding the brother marrying his widow, his brother's widow. On a number of circumstances, we're gonna find that she's gonna be prohibited perhaps to her original husband. He shouldn't have married her, but he did. Prohibited perhaps to the Yavam. And so, what the Mishnah here is gonna do, and now this will be comfortable. It'll take a little bit of time. But it's going to be comfortable in that the Mishnah here is going to be going over a number of the cases that we knew already, but it's just simply coming along as a review. In fact, you could take a look right away at the first Tosfos of the Perek. Perek of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yantav, Dekach Der Chatana. This is normal. And that is La'achash Shapir Shalachos HaMasechta. So we've gone through a lot of the halachas of this Masechta, Chozer V'shono Osam B'loshen Katzar. So what we're going to get to do is we're going to get to review the Gemara over here. Kedeshiyu Mesudarim Biyadecha. So that what's going to do is that's going to be all organized in your hand. Ushmurim Bepeh V'leiv. Okay, good. So this is going to be a great review of everything that we knew already. And then I'm going to save the second half of the Tosos, because Tosos is going to point out what else do we learn from this Mishnah? Meaning, Tosos is really bothered. The information that we're about to learn in this Mishnah over here is nothing new. Everything we know already. Okay, so great. So what's the purpose of it? So the first approach of Tosfos is Chazara, review, right? The Tanaim themselves recognize that we have just amassed a lot of information and there's a lot to keep straight. And so therefore it requires review. Everything requires review. That goes without saying. But this in particular definitely requires review to the point where we're going to be learning an entire Mishnah together where we're about to learn nothing new together, but it gives us an opportunity to review. That's really what's bothering Tosfos. Second half of Tosfos also is really interesting, and even though we're doing daf and we're doing this in short order, in a moment I'm going to go back to Tosfos. I'll do the second half of the Tosfos. Yesh mutaros lebaleim v'asuros leivayim, mutaros leivayim v'asuros lebaleim, mutaros leilu v'leilu v'asuros leilu v'eilu. So in the world of Yibum, as we've discussed since day one, so the construct always is that there are going to be two men involved, and there's going to be a woman. A woman was married to one of the men, he died, and now she becomes eligible for the mitzvah of Yibum to her brother-in-law. Okay, that's the construct of Yibum we all knew. But what we can do now in this Mishnah, what we are going to do in this Mishnah, is line it up into four different categories. Where? Category number one, so she was permitted to her husband. It was a lawful union between her and her original husband, and now once he dies, then she presents herself to her brother-in-law, Torah prohibits that union. It's weird, right? It's not weird. Meaning we're going to go over case after case where that could be the case. That's category number one. Category number two is where Mutaros Livnev Asur Slabalehem. Strange category. She shouldn't have married her original husband. She did. Okay, it happens. And now, husband dies. And she's Muteris to her Yavam. Wow, that's exciting. And in fact, that's the second case. And the third case is where it was a sanctioned marriage between her and her original husband and her Yavam. And case number four is where she's also to both. Now let's quickly go back to Tosos. So Odo Marie, back to Tosos, second half of Tosos, did Nakina Lakula Mishum, Bava da Sursa Baalem and Mutos Li of Mayhem. Right? That second category. Tosos says, wow, is that an exciting category. Why? Because consider what we would have entertained as an argument, as a plausible argument. She shouldn't have been married to her husband. Okay? But for halachic reasons, as we're going to go over, she's allowed to marry her Yavam. In other words, the Torah sanctions that marriage. One could have made the argument of, wait one second, what's the role of the Yavam? He's just simply filling in for his late brother. It's exactly what Yehuda told Onan after Er dies. You're going to take the place of Er. You're going to be a substitute for Er. Oh, so if that's the idea behind Yibum, so now you could have made an argument. It's a very plausible argument that if the original marriage was an illicit marriage, so now you return to the Yavam. You're taking place of the deceased brother. Wait one second. That deceased brother got involved in a marriage he shouldn't have gotten involved in. So maybe we would say to the Yavam, since you're a stand-in for the brother, so therefore you shouldn't marry her. I know technically you're mutter to marry her, but you're not marrying her qua you. You're marrying her qua your brother. That you can't do. So what the Mishnah really wants to highlight, articulate, is really the second category. That despite the fact that the original marriage was illicit, the Yavam can go ahead and marry her. Okay? It's an exciting idea. Obviously. If the Kedushin is not Tosfos, then we have no mitzvah of what to talk about. Okay, number one. Kohen Edger should not say Amana, v'yishlovach Kohen Gadol. So, Kohen Edger marries an Amana, right? This is category number one. Muteris to her original husband, usher now to the Yavam. So, example number one over here is where you have a Kohen Edger married to an Amana, a perfectly sanctioned union. A Kohen's allowed to marry an Amana, and he dies, and who happens to be the surviving brother? Kohen Gadol. Okay, good. Perfect example. Kohen Gadol, of course, is not allowed to marry an Amana. Category number two. Chalal shenasa kshera, so you have a chalal marrying a kshera. Okay, now remember, what's the chalal? Anytime you have a Kohen marrying a woman he's not allowed to marry, she automatically becomes a chalal just by having relations, and any child they have is a chalal. Okay, so simple example. Kohen marries a grusha. The woman herself becomes a chalala by having relations with her husband. Okay, and all the children are chalala. Male children are called a chalal, female children are called chalalim. Which means what? They no longer have kedushas kahuna. Done. They're not doing the avoda. They're not getting the covet of being a kohen. They're not getting truma, etc., etc. So now you have a chalal marrying a kshera. Now this in of itself is interesting. The prohibition of marrying a chalal is to whom? Only to a kohen. The Torah only prohibits a kohen from marrying a chalala. So, if let's say, for example, the man is a chalal, right? He's a product of a kohen and a grusha. And he's a chalal. So, is he allowed to marry a bas Yisrael? 100%. That is a perfectly sanctioned union. Okay, now, here's the interesting part. They're married. It's a legitimate union. Now they have relations. His chalal status gets passed on to her. Even though, this little detail over here, this takes processing. This definitely is something that takes a moment to absorb, which is why right now I'm going a little bit slower. In other words, she now becomes a halala, despite the fact it's not a prohibited union. The marriage itself is perfectly legitimate, but because it's a halala and wants to have relations, so the halala status goes to her. She now becomes a halala. So you have a halal shenasuk shera, v'yesh lach kasher, and it happens to be that his brother is not a halal, right? How can two brothers, one be a halal and the other one not being a halal? Very simple. Two different mothers. Okay. His mother was a divorcee, and the other brother's mother was not a divorcee. Okay, so everyone following? So the halal marries a woman, so he passes his halal status on to her. He dies. She now presents the zibum to the brother, to the surviving brother. Ah, but he's a kasher. He can't marry her. Yisrael shenasa bas Yisrael v'yishlo ach mamzer. Yisrael marries a bas Yisrael, and his brother happens to be a mamzer. Again, how could that possibly be that you have two brothers, one being a mamzer, one not being a mamzer? Again, the answer is really simple. Two different mothers. Okay. One mother was a mamzer and the other one was not a mamzer. Or let me say it better. One would be a mamzeris. Either way. So so that also would be an excellent illustration. And then finally, a fourth example. Mamzer shadasa mamzeris v'yeshlo ach Yisrael. A mamzer marries a mamzeris. Perfectly legitimate union. 100% kosher. And happens to be that his brother's Yisrael. Again, two different mothers. So mutasa ba'alem v'asrosli of mayhem. So in these four examples, these lists are not exhaustive. The Gemara is going to make that point on the Amud Beis. I don't think we're going to get there today. But regardless, it's not an exhaustive list, but four very straightforward examples where the woman was permitted to her original husband, but for the four, we just went over four different reasons, she would be prohibited to marry her Yavam. And what did we learn earlier in the Masechta? Going all the way back, this takes us a while back earlier, that once she's prohibited to her Yavam, so the mitzvah of Yavam doesn't just simply dissipate, it doesn't disappear. We're not talking about a rice over here. We're just talking about various lavim in the Torah. But still, they're going to have to do chalitza. They cannot perform the mitzvah of Yibum. Why don't we say esei docha lo sasei? So that's a question that we asked earlier in the Masechta. That happens to be, we're going to ask that question again, but it's going to be the same answer. Okay. Now we're going to go in the other direction. She was these are the women that are permitted to the Yavam, but were prohibited to their original husband. And again, Tosfos loves this category, because in the second approach of Tosfos, which we did this morning, Tosfos says, this is why we're learning the Mishnah. This is the real excitement behind this Mishnah, because you would think that the Yavam is a stand-in for the late husband. And if the late husband was prohibited to her, the Yavam should also be prohibited to her as well. We don't say that. It's a real interesting phenomenon. So what are examples where she was prohibited to her original husband, but she's allowed to marry her Yavam? So again, numerous examples over here. Kohen Gadol, Shekidesh Es Aman of Yeshlo Ach Hejot. So let's say you have the Kohen Gadol who is Mekadesh the Amana. Okay, anyone want to take a guess why he's Mekadesh the Amana? Meaning, why didn't he marry the Amana? Either way, it's prohibited. Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry an Amana. Neither through Kedushin and certainly not through Nisuin. Why only Kedushin? Why stop at Kedushin? Why not say that they went to the second stage of marriage? But the answer is really simple. Because if they go to the second stage of marriage, what does that make her? Makes her halala. Now, what does that mean regarding the surviving brother? She'd be asked to him as well. We're looking for cases where she's asked to her original husband, mutter to the Yavam. Ah. So the Kohen Gadol was Mekadesh the Amana. They didn't have relations, so he dies. He dies only from Kedushin. Is there a mitzvah of Yibum? Again, over here, 100%. The mitzvah of Yibum is both from Kedushin, from Erisin, and from Nisuin. That was a point that we already established well earlier in the Masechta. Anyway, again, this whole perek right now, the first mitzvah of this perek, is all for the purposes of review. So the Kohen Gadol is Mekadesh Amana. Kohen Gadol dies, now leaves her to her brother-in-law for the mitzvah of Yibum. Ah, an example of the original husband shouldn't have married her. He did, but she's perfectly muteris to her Yavam. Second example. Kasha shenasa chalala v'yeshlo achalal. So let's say Kasha marries a chalala. Again, he should not have done that, but he did. And then he dies. happens to be that the surviving brother is a chala. Again, different mothers. Perfectly possible. A third example. Yisrael marries a mamzeres. He should not have done that. Right? It is an isser in the Torah for Yisrael to marry a mamzeres, but he did anyway. And it happens to be that his brother's a mamzer. Again, two different mothers. It's possible. That was a third example. Here we go with a fourth example. Mamzer should not have the Bas Yisrael. So the mamzer marries the Bas Yisrael. Again, the mamzer should not be marrying the Bas Yisrael. That's an isser in the Torah. And v'yishlach Yisrael. And it happens to be that his brother's Yisrael. Now, interesting, by the way, halal is passed through from the original husband to the wife through the act of relations. Mamzeres does not pass through. Meaning, even though they have relations with one another, he's a mamzer, she's a bas yisrael, she remains a bas yisrael. Okay, she doesn't become a mamzer through the act of biyum. So, and he dies, and it happens to be that he has a brother who is a kasher yisrael. Good, that's a fourth example. Okay, so category number one for examples. Category number two for examples. Ve'elu asurus la'elu u'la'elu. Give me some examples where she would be prohibited to both her husband and the yavam. So Gemara says no problem. Kohen gadol shenasa samana v'yeshlo ach kohen gadol. So kohen gadol marries an amana, and it happens to be the surviving brother is a kohen gadol. What? Yeah, right, right. What? Yeah, right. The isn't there only one chieftain? How can you have two Kohen Gadols? The answer is you can. Okay. One could be Kohen Gadol Sha'avar. It's possible. Okay. Kohen Hedjah. Kohen Gadol Shanasa Samana Vyeshla Ach Kohen Gadol. Oh, Kohen Hedjah. Okay. Here, it doesn't really matter if the surviving brother is a Kohen Gadol or a Kohen Hedjah. Why? Because again, once a Kohen Gadol marries the Amana and they have relations, she now becomes a halala, prohibited to every single Kohen, regardless of whether that Kohen is a Kohen Gadol or Kohen Hedjah. Okay, that's example number one, asuras to both. Example number two, kasher shenasa halala v'yesh lo ach kasher. The kasher marries a halala and his brother is a kasher. So she was prohibited to her original husband. She's a halala, he's a Kohen. No good. And the surviving brother also is a Kohen. Also no good. Yisrael shenasa mamzeres v'yesh lo ach Yisrael. These examples are pretty simple, by the way. In other words, all we're looking for are cases where the woman would be usher to both. Okay, so she's a mamzeres, and happens to be the original husband was not a mamzer, an illicit union, and the surviving brother also is not a mamzer. Okay. Mamzer shenasa bas yisrael v'yesh lo ach mamzer. So, or alternatively, he's a mamzer, the original husband, she's a yisraelis, that marriage is prohibited, he dies, and it happens to be the surviving brother also is a mamzer. So asur leilo leilo, ushar kol nashim mutars lebalei maliv mehem. Now, as far as the fourth category is concerned, the Mishnah says, "Please don't bother me." Meaning, most of the time it'll be a lawful union between her and the original husband, and her and her yavam. Meaning, what we are going over are the exceptions. The general default is that we're looking at a case of heter. Again, let's go over. The marriage is not sanctioned, but the marriage is recognized, right? We're not talking about Isuri Karis. We're only talking about Lavim throughout the entire Mishnah over here. So as far as the Lav is concerned, so Torah says don't do it, but if he does it, it takes hold, right? You and I know the Kohen marries a Grusha, right? The rabbi would say the Torah prohibits that union. You want to do it anyway? I'm not going to officiate. But if you can find someone to officiate, the marriage is a marriage. Yeah, and then the mitzvah of Yibam is going to be there. And then you have the interaction between the mitzvah of Yibam and the law of the Torah. And we're going to come back to that point in a little bit. Okay. Good. Shnios medivrei sofrim. So let's go over shnios. We're not going to go over what they are. That was a difficult sugya in our Gemara over here, taking us back to Daf Chaf and Chaf Aleph. Right? Just a short 60 days ago in the Daf. 2 months ago, we were learning shnios. Okay, seems like a long time ago. Sorry, walking down memory lane. So so when it comes to shnios medivrei sofrim, so let's say you married a woman who's a shnia. Okay, so awkwardly, let's say you married your grandmother. Okay, she's a shnia. Okay, the Torah doesn't prohibit her, but the rabbis added her to the list of arayas. Okay, they added a whole bunch of women to the list of arayas. All right, if you remember, I think our final number was 24 women they added. I think that was the final number. Regardless, it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters, of course. But the so there's a whole list, assortment of women that you are not allowed to marry. Relatives that the Torah doesn't prohibit, but the rabbis do prohibit. They go with the term shniyos. Shniyos basically are secondary level. Secondary because the Chachamim added to it. And by the way, this is an old gezeira, right? If you remember, if you recall, this goes all the way back to Shlomo HaMelech, who made these takanas. So shniyos medivrei sof from shniyos labavlo, shniyos liyavam. So let's say she's a shniyos to the husband, but not a shniyos to the avam, right? How can that be? So let's just say right now it can be. It can happen. Without going through the family tree right now. So asur labalam mutas liyavam. So she is prohibited to her husband, but she's mutter to yavam. Shnia liyavam velo shnia labal. Let's say she's a shnia to the yavam, but not a shnia to the baal. Asur liyavam umutas labal. Okay. She is prohibited to the yavam and permitted to the baal. Shnia lazel lazel, asur lazel lazel. So, and if she's a shnia to both brothers, so then she's going to be prohibited to both brothers. Fine. Now, ein laksuva, you decide, you made the executive decision that you're going to marry a woman who the rabbis prohibited to you. She's a shnia. Okay, you married your grandmother. I know it's a funny sentence, I know. But the truth of the matter is that just this morning alone, I said things that are much stranger. So, it's fine. So you married your grandmother. So, the Chachamim told you shouldn't have married her, meaning you violated an Issa Darabanan. So now, what are the consequences of doing so? Ein la ksuva. So that's a forfeiture for ksuva. Now, in other words, that's a punishment to her. Don't worry, there's also going to be punishments for him as well. So ein la ksuva velo peros. Also, in addition to that, there's also not going to be peros as well. So what are peros? So we've gone over numerous times that when she goes into the marriage and she has assets and she wants to retain her assets, but as part of the marriage contract, so the assets are her, the title of those assets belong to her, but he's allowed to get any of the dividends that those assets produce. If it's a land that produces fruit, he literally can take the fruit. And there the word peros can be applied both literally and figuratively, but it's not just fruit. It's all usages. Let's say she brings a car into the marriage, the car is hers, but he can drive the car around. Okay, peros. Okay, in this unlawful union, so he's not going to be able to enjoy peros. Look at Rashi over here. Velo peros. I'm reading the Rashi. Ein misham la peros kenich. I'm sorry. Peros nechse melug sha achal mishala ve'af agav de kamalam b'ksuvas tiknu perkona tachas peros nechse melug shu ochal kidenan lo kasav la deim tishtab ay afar kenich chayv levdosa shu tanai beizdin. So and now the quid pro quo, right? When we get to ksuvas and we get like right around to the midpoint of ksuvas. Right, mem zayin nun. So what we're going to learn is that there were various mutual beneficial takanas that were made from husband to wife to husband, and it's quid pro quo, meaning that he enjoys the peros. Why does he enjoy the peros? Because she has her get out of jail free card. Okay, I'm not trying to turn marriage into monopoly, but it's true. She has her get out of jail free card. Which means that that in the event that she's taken captive, it becomes his financial responsibility. Now, I know it's marriage, by the way. You would like to think that he also would be interested in redeeming her, in ransoming her. Okay? Perfect. But in addition to that, he is obligated. He's financially obligated to do so. Okay? The Gemara and Ksufas will speak about this in detail. So the Pirkon, so the his financial responsibility to redeem her is then going to afford him the opportunity to enjoy her peros. That's the quid pro quo of peros for pirkon, the pays, if you will, of the ksuva. And even if it's not written to the ksuva, Rashi gives us this detail, even if it's not written to the ksuva, it's still part of the ksuva contract. This is what's called tanai ksuva. Okay. Vizu, and over here in this union, ein chayv levzosa. And over here, he doesn't have to ransom her. If she's taken captive, he doesn't have to ransom her. Why? Because if you read the contract carefully, right, this is real contract law. If you read the contract carefully, it says that why is he going to ransom her? So he can bring her back to his house. Over here, all right, that's an unsanctioned marriage. It's an unlawful marriage. In other words, he shouldn't have married her to begin with. And certainly the Chachamim would say to him, We don't want you returning her to her house, meaning what we want you to do is we want you to divorce her. Ah, so now there's no longer a pirkon responsibility. And so now, once that goes, so then the other side of that goes as well. The peris go as well. Then Rashi goes on. It's a detail which I don't want to go over right now. In other words, what if he eats a peris? Does he have to reimburse? Okay. See more Rashi for more details over there. So, in an unlawful marriage, meaning the marriage still takes hold, but an unlawful marriage, so, what have we seen so far in the Mishnah? She forfeits her ksuva. He doesn't get peris. V'lo mazonos, she doesn't get support. V'lo balos, and on top of that, also, she doesn't get the worn-out clothing. Any clothing that she brings into the marriage, she takes back with her once the marriage terminates. This is what's called balos. Even though they're old and they're worn out, but nevertheless, she gets to keep them. In this particular case, once again, she forfeits that. The havlad kasher. The vlad is not a mamzer. This is not primary arayos. These are shnios. It's secondary. And so as a result of that, it does not produce a mamzer. The kofenos olahotzi. And of course, coercion is going to be done to the man that he divorced her. That would have been done throughout the entire marriage. Okay. I guess you could ask me the question, who's officiating this marriage? Like who did this? Right? Who is responsible for this? Unfortunately, this is not a new phenomena. This is an extraordinarily old phenomena. People do what they shouldn't be doing. And I'm talking about even rabbis officiating, meaning rabbis officiated over this marriage that they shouldn't have done, but they did. It's not a modern phenomenon.
Can you give us an example of a shniyah?
Grandmother. Yeah. Amal l'kohen gadol, grusha v'chalut. So when it comes to an amal l'kohen gadol, grusha chalut, l'kohen hajot, mamzer, so nesil l'yisrael abas, l'yisrael nesil l'mamzer, yesh lem ksuva. In all of these cases of Torah prohibited marriages, she does not forfeit a ksuva. The obvious question, which we're going to ask later, not today, but I'm just foreshadowing, and that is that in a shnia she forfeited a ksuva, and an iser de araisa of grusha to kohen and almana to kohen gadol, she doesn't forfeit a ksuva. How does that make sense? Stay tuned. Well, we're going to answer that question, but just simply not today. Let's do a little bit more over the course of the day. We're not going to finish it off, but certainly I want to get to the Amud Beis. My ear did need nasa. Listen to Kiddush. Okay? We are going to the case of the Kohen Hedjot Shenasas Almana. Okay? Kohen Hedjot married the Almana. Right? That's case number one. Meaning, in category number one, where she's mutter to her husband, but aser to her yavam, in case number one, category one, case one. So it's a Kohen Hedjot married an Almana. So the Gemara wants to know, Mayir Yedini Nasa, listen to Kiddush. Meaning, the Mishnah didn't have to get so involved. Meaning, he married her. He did the first and second stage of marriages with this woman. He's a Kohen. Again, she's a Mana. He's totally allowed to. He has license to marry her. But if all we want to do is just illustrate an example of category number one, we didn't have to go that far. Meaning, even if he was Mekadisher, and then he dies, that would also be a good example of she was mutter to her husband, but usher to her yavam. Because remember, what was the brother? The brother was a Kohen Gadol. Amana's not allowed to marry an Amana. Kohen Gadol's not allowed to marry an Amana. So why did the Mishnah have to go all the way to the point where the Kohen married her? We could have just simply said he was Mekadosher. V'chitem atam adonasa dahavalei asev lo sasei. Aval kiddush asei asev adoche lo sasei. So the Gemara says that maybe if he would have married her, so that represents two Isurim, both an Isur Esse and a Lo Sase, vis-a-vis the Kohen Gadol. Meaning, what's a Lo Sase? She's an Amana. What's the Esse? She's not a Besula. But if, let's say, he was Mekadisher, which leaves what on the table? Only leaves one thing on the table. And that, of course, is that she's an Amana. It could be that she's a Besula. And now all we're looking at is a Lav. And maybe, I don't know, the Kohen Gadol can marry her. Why? Because now here we are in a perfect illustration of Mitzvah Sase of Yibum versus a Lo Sase of an Amana. So, Ase Ase V'Doch Lo Sase, V'Akula Pirkin, Ase V'Lo Sase Hu, V'Lo Ase Ase V'Doch Lo Sase. So the Gemara says, come on, right? We've gone through a lot of cases in the Mishnah. I was about to give you a number, right? 12 cases in the Mishnah in total? Yeah, I think so. So we went through 12 cases in the Mishnah. And on those 12 cases, here I didn't tally, but a number of those cases are cases of esse dochelo sase. And meanwhile, we don't say that. Now, why don't we say that? So here I take us back to what we learned earlier in the Masechta, much earlier in the Masechta, and that is that normally we do say that a positive commandment overrides a negative prohibition. But in the case of Yibum, we don't say that. Why? Because when is a positive commandment? That's only for the first bia. Birishon is a mitzvah sase. All subsequent bias are not following the mitzvah of Yibum, meaning they're husband and wife, and it's a regular marriage, but that's not under the umbrella of the mitzvah. And now the mitzvah's gone after Bir Rishona, and all you're left with is a lav. So, and what are you going to suggest? The Gemara, for just even a moment, entertained it earlier in the Masechta. Also, they'll just do Bir Rishona and that's it? That's ridiculous, meaning that's absurd. So so all the cases of the Mishnah are esse dochelo sase, or that's what, at least what we would have thought, and it's rejected. So here as well, in our first case of the Mishnah, don't tell me that the only reason why the Mishnah elected to use the case of Nasav rather than Kidesh is because had it been Kidesh, then the positive commandment overrides the negative prohibition. It's simply not the case. So the Gemara says, okay, so again, why in the first case of our Mishnah did we say Nasa? He married her. Well, could have just simply said Kidesh. So Mishim Dekabai, Limis the Seifa, Kohen Gadol, Shanasa Salmana. So because of the Kohen Gadol marrying the Almana, meaning that's already in the third category. That was an unlawful union. Dafka Nasa Deshavi Chalala, because once he married her, he makes her Chalala. So Aval Kidesh, Sharyala. But if all he did is was Mekadesh her, so then they didn't have relations. She didn't become a Chalala. So Tana Nami Resha Nasa. That's why in the first case it says Nasa. Vad Nimishim Seifalis Nimishim Mitziasa. So the Gemara says, okay, I understand, but let's look at the second category. Kohen Gadol Shekidesh Es Amana V'yesh Lach Kohen Hedjot. Kohen Gadol marries an Amana, and he has a Kohen Hedjot. So over there, you have to use the word, Mekadesh. So if you're telling me that the word Nasa is because it's symmetrical to the third category, I'll tell you, use the word Kidesh, it becomes symmetrical to the second category. We've yet to give a good answer why the first case of the Mishnah, Kohen Hedjot, Shenasa Es Amana. It could easily have said Kidesh. So Elamishim Bas Bukya. So the Gemara says, so the reason why it says the word Nasa is because of the very next case, right? The Bas Bukya means basically its neighbor. The Kabai Lemesei Chala Shenasa Kshera. Because if you look at case number two, meaning category number one, case number two. So there, time of the Nasa Deshavi Chalala. There, how does the problem materialize? So we went over this in the Mishnah, but now you understand. The only way the problem materializes, the chalal marries a kshera. And as I explained in the Mishnah, and I'm going to repeat it again right now because it's just really, it's a chiddush. It's something that just requires more digestion. The idea that a chalal is allowed to marry stam, a Jewish woman, no problem whatsoever. Meaning it's a perfectly lawful union. But once they have relations, his chalal status now passes on to her. She now becomes a chalala. But that passing of the status only comes about through Bia. That's it. So there, in that second case of the Mishnah, if they only went through Kiddushin, she doesn't become a Chalala. So the only way that she can become a Chalala is only through Nisuin. So in the second case, it has to be Nisuin. But in the first case, I know it doesn't matter whether the Kohen Hedjot either was Noseis Amana or Mekashi Amana. But because the second case, by definition, has to be Nisuin, the first case also is going to write Nisuin. Ava Kiddush Ayyala Mishum Hachi Ketani Nasa. Umayir Yedik Tani Amana Lisne Besula. Gemara wants to know, okay, in that first case, Kohen Hedjot Shenasa S, now we have the case of Amana. The Gemara wants to know, didn't have to go that far. Meaning, why don't we just simply say Kohen Hedjot Shenasa S Ha Besula? Okay, meaning, right, nothing. In other words, this is her first time getting married, and now this would be a good case regarding category number one. Again, what's category number one? Mutter to her husband, usher to her brother-in-law. So let's say the Kohen Hedjot married a Besula, and it happens to be that the surviving brother-in-law is a Kohen Gadol. So why did the Mishnah do that? My ear diktani I'm on a listening Besula. V'chi teimam. Top of the next Amud. Kasav Raitan and Nisum Rishon Mapilin. The Gemara over here says, well, I know why. Because had it been talking about a Besula, maybe, now, I'm cautioning everybody, by the way. This is a funny maybe. Maybe she would be prohibited to, she would be, sorry, let me say it better. She would be permitted to her brother-in-law. I, her brother-in-law, is a Kohen Gadol. I, a Kohen Gadol, is not allowed to marry a Ba'ula. Yeah, but you know what? Maybe vis-a-vis her, she's a Basula. Because, right. That's a funny look. I deserve that funny look. Because maybe what we're going to say, we're going to suggest is that as far as the Yavam is concerned, what is he? He's a stand-in for the brother. He's a pinch hitter. Again, I don't know how many of you love the baseball reference. But in other words, he's a stand-in for the brother. Meaning when the brother married her, obviously at the beginning of the marriage, she was a basula. Maybe for the brother-in-law, the Kohen Gadol, he can also see her as a basula as he's a stand-in for the brother. What the Gemara is now suggesting is that we take out the word almana and substitute it with basula. Right. In other words, why didn't the Mishnah use that example? And what the Gemara now is suggesting, v'chitem, akasavra haitana, nisunem rishonem apilin, harei chalosh, anasak shera, v'lo amrin, nisunem rishonem apilin. The Gemara says, it's ridiculous. Meaning, you're right. He's a stand-in for the brother. He's a pinch hitter. Or you could say it however you want to say it. But when all said and done, I'm going to go over, the Gemara just gives one example. So many different examples where, if we were always to look at her original state when married to her, to the late brother, so she would have been mutter to the Yavam. But we don't say that. Meaning when she's presented to the Yavam, we look at her as she is right now, not the way she originally was. So you can't make the argument. In fact, you can see the Taptosis over here where he just can't even imagine that the Gemara just tried to make the argument. Okay, the Gemara rejected it. But you can't make the argument and say that you look at this woman as she originally was to the original husband. You don't do that. The only way you look at her vis-a-vis the Abam is in her current state. And right now, to the surviving brother who happens to be a Kohen Gadol, she's not a Basula, she's not permitted. So, Hava de Mishum Seifa, Mishum de Kabbalah Misa Seifa. So the Gemara says, okay, so, question on the table. In case number one of the Mishnah, it says, what happened to Kohen Hedjo married an Amana? Why didn't the Mishnah just give another example of Kohen Gadol marrying the Basula? Now, again, by the way, to all these questions, the Gemara is going to say, we'll get to it tomorrow. To all these questions, you know, the Mishnah is just not an exhaustive list. Meaning, you're right. The Mishnah could have given this case, and that case, and this case, and that case. It's just an assortment of examples. There are other examples as well. But, vis-a-vis this particular question, Havan, Mishnah Sefer, Mishnah Dekabai, let me say Sefer, Kohen Gadol, Shonasa, Samana, V'ishlach, Kohen Gadol, O Kohen Hedjot. So, in the next category, where the Kohen Gadol marries an Amana, an unlawful marriage, and he happens to have a brother, and his brother is either Kohen Gadol or Kohen Hedjot. Let's focus right now on Kohen Hedjot. So there, Dafka Amana. So there has to be an Amana. So Ava Basula Chazile, had she been a Basula, then it would have been fine. Mishum Hachi Ketani Amana. That's why the Mishnah gives the word Amana. Meaning, basically, contrast. We like the contrasting cases of the Mishnah. Since the second category, we have to use the word amana. We can't use basula. So in the first category, we're going to use amana as well. Okay. We're going to pause awkwardly right over here by Maskefla Repapa. Tomorrow we'll pick it up over here. Okay, let's quickly recap. Let's review. We ended the eighth parak of the Masechta this morning. The midpoint in Prakim of the Masechta, we are halfway done in terms of Prakim. In terms of Dapim, we only have a third left in the Masechta. But here at the end of Perek Ha'ara, which was a sizable Perek, nearly 14 blot of Gemara. So we've gone over a number of issues that relate to the man and his genital area. Okay, an indelicate Perek, to say the least, but obviously, Halacha, Torah, and every word, every letter that we learned of this Perek is all a kiyum of Talmud Torah. And at the end of today's daf, so we had a couple of really indelicate discussions regarding the androgynous and the status of the androgynous. Androgynous is a male, according to Rabbi Eliezer. Truth of the matter is, even according to Rav Yossi, the androgynous is a male as well. Again, the Amoraim debate exactly to what degree we're going to say he's a male, but it's something that we could say pretty definitively, as far as Shita's Rabbi Eliezer, and mostly Rabbi Yossi. Again, yesterday's daf, we were really complicated because the Bryce of Rabbi Yossi said that it was a Birya Bifnei Atzma. Okay, so, but according to Rabbi Eliezer, androgynous is a male, qualifies as a male, if involved in Mishkav Zachor, subject to capital punishment. And then in the beginning of today's daf, is there two entrances, orifices in which it can be involved in Mishkav Zachor, Machlokas Tanaim, a debate about how to darshan the Psukim. To what degree is Rabbi Eliezer going to say that our androgynous is going to be a male? So as far as people are concerned, humans are concerned, so 100%. But as far as the animals are concerned, so there are limits. And we went over at the end of the perek, the limits of Rabbi Eliezer were by an animal. If we went over birds, for example, that a bird that was an androgynous that had Malika. So according to Rabbi Eliezer, the bird is in fact going to be a novella because the androgynous is a nondescript male female by a bird. Okay, so the point is that according to Rabbi Eliezer, there's a limit to how far he's ready to say that androgynous is a male. But by a human, 100% male. And then we ended off the parak with a strange story. Quite frankly, I don't know what to make of the story. Rebbe goes and learns Torah by Rabbi Eliezer ben Shamua and only able to learn one halacha. This particular halacha, what exactly happened, what's happening over there? I wish I knew. That's the end of the 8th parak. And then we started this morning the 9th parak. And the 9th parak, so what we got to do, it says Tosfos Chazara. We got to review. So many of the cases that we knew already, but we're organizing the information, presenting it in a different format, and it's a great opportunity to review. What is the structure of the first mission of the 9th parak? So 4 categories. Category 1, she's mutter to husband, but usher to her yavam. Category 2, she is usher to her husband, but mutter to yavam. Category 3, usher to both. Category 4, muteris to both. And what the Mishnah did is give examples, illustrations of categories 1, 2, and 3. 4 examples for each of the first 3 categories. What about category number 4? The Mishnah says, don't bother me with category number 4, because that's most cases. Most cases is she's mutter to her husband and she's mutter to the yavam. So, the Mishnah tells us that what happens where she's a shnia to one and not the other, basically the same, but also what the Mishnah wants to do is that when a man marries a shnia, a woman who is rabbinically prohibited to her, so there's going to be a lot of forfeiting of the financial benefits that come with marriage. She forfeits her ksuva, he's forfeiting the peros, she doesn't get balaos, so there's going to be a forfeiture of finances because they violate an issur derabbanan. Oddly enough, the Mishnah ends off by saying that if let's say, for example, Cohen marries a grusha, which is a Torah prohibition, she doesn't forfeit her ksuva. We have to give an explanation, but that's coming up on a later daf. And then, we started with the Gemara. The Gemara just really nitpicked on the Mishnah. Why did the Mishnah give this case? Why did the Mishnah give this case? So we are nitpicking within the Mishnah. Ultimately, what we're going to see tomorrow is that the Mishnah is not an exhaustive list, so you really don't have to nitpick to the degree in which we did, but that's what the Gemara does.